Us quarters. Sharing the secret of her continued success, she says, there is something about seeing myself improve that motivates and excites me. It's that way now, after 6 Olympic medals and 5 world records, and it was the way I was in junior high, just starting to enter track meets. Her last 2 medals, a world championship and an Olympic medal, came during an asthma attack and a severe, painful hamstring injury. It was not natural talent taking its course. It was mindset having its say. Naturals shouldn't need effort. Did you know there was once a strong belief that you couldn't physically train for golf, and that if you built your strength, you would lose your touch? Until Tiger Woods came along with his workout regimes and fierce practice habits and won every tournament there was to win. In some cultures, people who tried to go beyond their natural talent through training received sharp disapproval. You were supposed to accept your station in life. These cultures would have hated Maury Wills. Wills was an eager baseball player in the 1950s and 60s with a dream to be a major leaguer. His problem was that his hitting wasn't good enough. So when the Dodgers signed him, they sent him down to the minor leagues. He proudly announced to his friends, "In 2 years, I'm going to be in Brooklyn playing with Jackie Robinson." He was wrong. Despite his optimistic prediction and grueling daily practice, he languished in the minors for 8.5 years. At the 7.5-year mark, the team manager made a batting suggestion, telling Wills, "You're in a 7.5-year slump, you have nothing to lose." Shortly thereafter, when the Dodgers shortstop broke his toe, Wills was called up. He had his chance. His batting was still not good enough. Not ready to give up, he went to the first base coach for help. They worked together several hours a day, aside from Wills' regular practice. Still not good enough. Even the gritty Wills was now ready to quit. But the first base coach refused to let him. Now that the mechanics were in place, Wills needed to work on his mind. He began to hit, and with his great speed, he began to steal bases. He studied the throws of the opposing pitchers and catchers, figuring out the best moment to steal a base. He developed sudden, powerful takeoffs and effective slides. His stealing began to distract the pitchers, throw off the catchers, and thrill the fans. Wills went on to break Ty Cobb's record for stolen bases, a record unchallenged for 47 years. That season, he was voted the most valuable player in the National League. Sports IQ. You would think the sports world would have to see the relation between practice and improvement, and between the mind and performance, and stop harping so much on innate physical talent. Yet it's almost as if they refuse to see. Perhaps it's because, as Malcolm Gladwell suggests, people prize natural endowment over earned ability. As much as our culture talks about individual effort and self-improvement, deep down, he argues, we revere the naturals. We like to think of our champions and idols as superheroes who were born different from us. We don't like to think of them as relatively ordinary people who made themselves extraordinary. Why not? To me, that is so much more amazing. Even when experts are willing to recognize the role of the mind, they continue to insist that it's all innate. This really hit me when I came upon an article about Marshall Faulk, the great running back for the St. Louis Rams football team. Faulk had just become the first player to gain a combined 2,000 rushing and receiving yards in 4 consecutive seasons. The article, written on the eve of the 2002 Super Bowl, talked about Faulk's uncanny skill at knowing where every player on the field is, even in the swirling chaos of 22 running and falling players. He not only knows where they are, but he also knows what they are doing and what they are about to do. According to his teammates, he's never wrong. Incredible. How does he do it? As Faulk tells it, he spent years and years watching football. In high school, he even got a job as a ballpark vendor, which he hated, in order to watch pro football. As he watched, he was always asking the question, why? Why are we running this play? Why are we attacking this way? Why are they doing that? Why are they doing this? That question, Faulk says, basically got me involved in football in a more in-depth way. As a pro, he never stopped asking why and probing deeper into the workings of the game. Clearly, Faulk himself sees his skills as the product of his insatiable curiosity and study. How do players and coaches see it? As a gift. Marshall has the highest football IQ of any position player I've ever played with, says a veteran teammate. Other teammates describe his ability to recognize defensive alignments flawlessly as a savant's gift. In awe of his array of skills, one coach explained, "It takes a very innate football intelligence to do all that." Character. But aren't there some naturals, athletes who really seem to have it from the start? Yes. And as it was for Billy Beane and John McEnroe, sometimes it's a curse. With all the praise for their talent and with how little they've needed to work or stretch themselves, they can easily fall into a fixed mindset. Bruce Jenner, 1976 Olympic gold medalist in the decathlon, says, "If I wasn't dyslexic, I probably wouldn't have won the games. If I had been a better reader, then that would have come easily. Sports would have come easily. And I never would have realized that the way you get ahead in life is hard work." The naturals, carried away with their superiority, don't learn how to work hard or how to cope with setbacks. This is the story of Pedro Martinez, the brilliant pitcher then with the Boston Red Sox, who self-destructed when they needed him most. But it's an even larger story, too. A story about character. A group of sports writers from the New York Times and the Boston Globe were on the Delta shuttle to Boston. So was I. They were headed to Game 3 of the 2003 American League playoff series between the New York Yankees and the Boston Red Sox. They were talking about character, and they all agreed, the Boston writers reluctantly, that the Yankees had it. Among other things, they remembered what the Yankees had done for New York 2 years before. It was October 2001, and New Yorkers had just lived through September 11th. I was there, and we were devastated. We needed some hope. The city needed the Yankees to go for it, to go for the World Series. But the Yankees had lived through it too, and they were injured and exhausted. They seemed to have nothing left. I don't know where they got it from, but they dug down deep and they polished off one team after another, each win bringing us a little bit back to life, each one giving us a little more hope for the future. Fueled by our need, they became the American League East champs, then the American League champs, and then they were in the World Series, where they made a valiant run and almost pulled it off. Everyone hates the Yankees. It's the team the whole country roots against. I grew up hating the Yankees, too, but after that, I had to love them. This is what the sports writers meant by character. Character, the sports writers said. They know it when they see it. It's the ability to dig down and find the strength even when things are going against you. The very next day, Pedro Martinez, the dazzling but over-pampered Boston pitcher, showed what character meant by showing what it isn't. No one could have wanted this American League championship more than the Boston Red Sox. They hadn't won a World Series in 85 years, ever since the curse of the Bambino, that is, ever since Sox owner Harry Frazee sold Babe Ruth to the Yankees for money to finance a Broadway show. It was bad enough that he was selling the best left-handed pitcher in baseball, which Ruth was at the time, but he was selling him to the despised enemy. The Yankees went on to dominate baseball, winning, it seemed, endless World Series. Meanwhile, Boston made it to 4 World Series and several playoffs, but they always lost. And they always lost in the most tragic way possible, by coming achingly near to victory and then having a meltdown. Here, finally, was another chance to fight off the curse and defeat their arch-rivals. If they won, they would make that trip to the World Series and the Yankees would stay home. Pedro Martinez was their hope. In fact, earlier in the season, he had cursed the curse. Yet after pitching a beautiful game, Martinez was losing his lead and falling behind. What did he do then? He hit a batter with the ball. Kareem Garcia threatened to bean another, Jorge Posada, and hurled a 72-year-old man to the ground, Yankee coach Don Zimmer. As New York Times writer Jack Curry wrote, "We knew we were going to have Pedro versus Roger, Clemens, on a memorable afternoon at Fenway Park. But no one expected to watch Pedro against Garcia, Pedro against Posada, Pedro against Zimmer." Even the Boston writers were aghast. Dan Shaughnessy of the Globe asked, "Which one would you rather have now, Red Sox fans? Roger Clemens, who kept his composure and behaved like a professional Saturday night, winning the game for his team despite his obvious anger? Or Martinez, the baby who hits a guy after he blows the lead, then points at his head and at Yankees catcher Jorge Posada, threatening, 'You're next.' Red Sox fans don't like to hear this, but Martinez was an embarrassment Saturday and a disgrace to baseball. He gets away with it because he's Pedro, and the Sox front office enables him. Could Martinez one time stand up and admit he's wrong? Like Billy Bean, Pedro Martinez did not know how to tolerate frustration, did not know how to dig down and turn an important setback into an important win. Nor, like Billy Bean, could he admit his faults and learn from them. Because he threw his tantrum instead of doing the job, the Yankees won the game and went on to win the playoff by one game. The sports writers on the plane agreed that character is all, but they confessed that they didn't understand where it comes from. Yet I think by now we're getting the idea that character grows out of mindset. We now know that there's a mindset in which people are enmeshed in the idea of their own talent and specialness. When things go wrong, they lose their focus and their ability, putting everything they want, and in this case, everything the team and the fans so desperately want, in jeopardy. We also know that there is a mindset that helps people cope well with setbacks, points them to good strategies, and leads them to act in their best interest. Wait, the story's not over. 1 year later, the Sox and the Yankees went head-to-head again. Whoever won 4 games out of the 7 would be the American League champions and would take that trip to the World Series. The Yankees won the first 3 games, and Boston's humiliating fate seemed sealed once again. But that year, Boston had put their prima donnas on notice. They traded one, tried to trade another, no one wanted him, and sent out the message, "This is a team, not a bunch of stars. We work hard for each other." 4 games later, the Boston Red Sox were the American League champions, and then the world champions. It was the first time since 1904 that Boston had beaten the Yankees in a championship series, showing 2 things. First, that the curse was over. And second, that character can be learned. More about character. Let's take it from the top with Pete Sampras and the growth mindset. In 2000, Sampras was at the Wimbledon, trying for his 13th Grand Slam tennis victory. If he won, he would break Roy Emerson's record of 12 wins in top tournaments. Although Sampras managed to make it to the finals, he had not played that well in the tournament and was not optimistic about his chances against the young, powerful Patrick Rafter. Sampras lost the first set and was about to lose the second set. He was down 4-1 in the tiebreaker. Even he said, "I really felt like it was slipping away." What would McEnroe have done? What would Pedro Martinez have done? What did Sampras do? As William Roden puts it, he searched for a frame of reference that could carry him through. Sampras says, "When you're sitting on the changeover, you think of past matches that you've lost the first set, came back and won the next 3. There's time. You reflect on your past experiences, being able to get through it." Suddenly, Sampras had a 5-point run, then 2 more. He had won the second set and he was alive. "Last night," Roden says, "Sampras displayed all the qualities of the hero. The loss in the first set, vulnerability near defeat, then a comeback and a final triumph." Jackie Joyner-Kersee talked herself through an asthma attack during her last world championship. She was in the 800-meter race, the last event of the heptathlon, when she felt the attack coming on. "Just keep pumping your arms," she instructed herself. "It's not that bad, so keep going. You can make it. You're not going to have a full-blown attack. You have enough air. You got this thing won. Just run as hard as you can in this last 200 meters, Jackie." She instructed herself all the way to victory. "I have to say this is my greatest triumph, considering the competition and the ups and downs I was going through. If I really wanted it, I had to pull it together." In her last Olympics, the dreaded thing happened. A serious hamstring injury forced her to drop out of the heptathlon. She was devastated. She was no longer a contender in her signature event. But would she be a contender in the long jump a few days later? Her first 5 jumps said no. They were nowhere near medal level. But the 6th jump won her a bronze medal, more precious than her gold ones. "The strength for that 6th jump came from my assorted heartbreaks over the years. I'd collected all my pains and turned them into one mighty performance." Joyner-Kersee, too, displayed all the qualities of a hero: the loss, the vulnerability near defeat, then a comeback and a final triumph. Character, heart, will, and the mind of a champion. It goes by different names, but it's the same thing. It's what makes you practice, and it's what allows you to dig down and pull it out when you most need it. Remember how McEnroe told us all the things that went wrong to make him lose each match he lost? There was the time it was cold, and the time it was hot, the time he was jealous, and the times he was upset, and the many, many times he was distracted. But as Billie Jean King tells us, the mark of a champion is the ability to win when things are not quite right, when you're not playing well, and your emotions are not the right ones. Here's how she learned what being a champion meant. King was in the finals at Forest Hills playing against Margaret Smith, later Margaret Smith Court, who was at the peak of her greatness. King had played her more than a dozen times and had beaten her only once. In the first set, King played fabulously. She didn't miss a volley and she built a nice lead. Suddenly, the set was over. Smith had won it. In the second set, King again built a commanding lead and was serving to win the set. Before she knew it, Smith had won the set and the match. At first, King was perplexed. She had never built such a commanding lead in such an important match. But then she had a eureka moment. All at once, she understood what a champion was, someone who could raise their level of play when they needed to. When the match is on the line, they suddenly get around three times tougher. Jackie Joyner-Kersee had her eureka moment, too. She was 15 years old and competing in the heptathlon at the AAU Junior Olympics. Everything now depended on the last event, the 800-meter race, an event she dreaded. She was exhausted and she was competing against an expert distance runner whose times she had never matched. She did this time. "I felt a kind of high. I'd proven that I could win if I wanted it badly enough. That win showed me that I could not only compete with the best athletes in the country, I could will myself to win." Often called the best woman soccer player in the world, Mia Hamm says she was always asked, "Mia, what is the most important thing for a soccer player to have?" With no hesitation, she answered, "Mental toughness," and she didn't mean some innate trait. When 11 players want to knock you down, when you're tired or injured, when the referees are against you, you can't let any of it affect your focus. How do you do that? You have to learn how. "It is," said Hamm, "one of the most difficult aspects of soccer, and the one I struggle with every game and every practice." By the way, did Hamm think she was the greatest player in the world? No. "And because of that," she said, "someday I just might be." In sports, there are always do-or-die situations, when a player must come through or it's all over. Jack Nicklaus, the famed golfer, was in these situations many times in his long professional career on the PGA Tour, where the tournament rested on his making a must-have shot. If you had to guess, how many of these shots do you think he missed? The answer is one. One. That's the championship mentality. It's how people who are not as talented as their opponents win games. John Wooden, the legendary basketball coach, tells one of my favorite stories. Once, while Wooden was still a high school coach, a player was unhappy because he wasn't included in the big games. The player, Eddie Pawelski, begged Wooden to give him a chance, and Wooden relented. "All right, Eddie," he said, "I'll give you a chance. I'll start you against Fort Wayne Central tomorrow night." Suddenly, Wooden tells us, I wondered where those words came from. Three teams were locked in a battle for number one in Indiana. One was his team and another was Fort Wayne Central, tomorrow night's team. The next night, Wooden started Eddie. He figured that Eddie would last at most a minute or two, especially since he was up against Fort Wayne's Armstrong, the toughest player in the state. Eddie literally took him apart, Wooden reports. Armstrong got the lowest point total of his career. Eddie scored 12, and our team showed the best balance of all season. But in addition to his scoring, his defense, rebounding, and playmaking were excellent. Eddie never sat out again and was named most valuable player for the next 2 years. All of these people had character. None of them thought they were special people, born with the right to win. They were people who worked hard, who learned how to keep their focus under pressure, and who stretched beyond their ordinary abilities when they had to. Staying on top. Character is what allows you to reach the top and stay there. Daryl Strawberry, Mike Tyson, and Martina Hingis reached the top, but they didn't stay there. Isn't that because they had all kinds of personal problems and injuries? Yes, but so have many other champions. Ben Hogan was hit by a bus and was physically destroyed, but he made it back to the top. I believe ability can get you to the top, says Coach John Wooden, but it takes character to keep you there. It's so easy to begin thinking you can just turn it on automatically without proper preparation. It takes real character to keep working as hard or even harder once you're there. When you read about an athlete or team that wins over and over and over, remind yourself, more than ability, they have character. Let's take an even deeper look at what character means and how the growth mindset creates it. Stuart Biddle and his colleagues measured adolescents' and young adults' mindset about athletic ability. Those with a fixed mindset were the people who believed that you have a certain level of ability in sports and you cannot really do much to change that level. To be good at sports, you need to be naturally gifted. In contrast, the people with the growth mindset agreed that how good you are at sports will always improve if you work harder at it. To be successful in sports, you need to learn technique and skills and practice them regularly. Those with the growth mindset were the ones who showed the most character or heart. They were the ones who had the minds of champions. What do I mean? Let's look at the findings from these sports researchers and see. What is success? Finding number one. Those with the growth mindset found success in doing their best, in learning and improving. And this is exactly what we find in the champions. For me, the joy of athletics has never resided in winning, Jackie Joyner-Kersee tells us. I derive just as much happiness from the process as from the results. I don't mind losing as long as I see improvement or I feel I've done as well as I possibly could. If I lose, I just go back to the track and work some more. This idea that personal success is when you work your hardest to become your best was central to John Wooden's life. In fact, he says, there were many, many games that gave me as much pleasure as any of the 10 national championship games we won, simply because we prepared fully and played near our highest level of ability. Tiger Woods and Mia Hamm are two of the fiercest competitors who ever lived. They loved to win. But what counted most for them is the effort they made even when they didn't win. They could be proud of that. McEnroe and Bean could not. After the 98 Masters tournament, Woods was disappointed that he did not repeat his win of the previous year, but he felt good about his top 10 finish. I squeezed the towel dry this week. I'm very proud of the way I hung in there. Or after a British Open, where he finished third. Sometimes you get even more satisfaction out of creating a score when things aren't completely perfect, when you're not feeling so well about your swing. Tiger is a hugely ambitious man. He wants to be the best, even the best ever. But the best me, that's a little more important. Mia Hamm tells us, after every game or practice, if you walk off the field knowing that you gave everything you had, you will always be a winner. Why did the country fall in love with her team? They saw that we truly love what we do and that we gave everything we had to each other and to each game. For those with the fixed mindset, success is about establishing their superiority, pure and simple. Being that somebody who is worthier than the nobodies. There was a time, I'll admit it, McEnroe says, when my head was so big it could barely fit through the door. Where's the talk about effort and personal best? There is none. Some people don't want to rehearse, they just want to perform. Other people want to practice 100 times first. I'm in the former group. Remember, in the fixed mindset, effort is not a cause for pride. It is something that casts doubt on your talent. What is failure? Finding number two. Those with the growth mindset found setbacks motivating. They're informative. They're a wake-up call. Only once did Michael Jordan try to coast. It was the year he returned to the Bulls after his stint in baseball, and he learned his lesson. The Bulls were eliminated in the playoffs. You can't leave and think you can come back and dominate this game. I will be physically and mentally prepared from now on. Truer words are rarely spoken. The Bulls won the NBA title the next 3 years. Michael Jordan embraced his failures. In fact, in one of his favorite ads for Nike, he says, I've missed more than 9,000 shots. I've lost almost 300 games. 26 times I've been trusted to take the game-winning shot and missed. You can be sure that each time he went back and practiced the shot 100 times. Here's how Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the great basketball player, reacted when college basketball outlawed his signature shot, the dunk, later reinstated. Many thought that would stop his ascent to greatness. Instead, he worked twice as hard on developing other shots, his bank shot off the glass, his skyhook, and his turnaround jumper. He had absorbed the growth mindset from Coach Wooden and put it to good use. In the fixed mindset, setbacks label you. John McEnroe could never stand the thought of losing. Even worse was the thought of losing to someone who was a friend or relative. That would make him less special. For example, he hoped desperately for his best friend Peter to lose in the finals at Maui after Peter had beaten him in an earlier round. He wanted it so badly he couldn't watch the match. Another time, he played his brother Patrick in a finals in Chicago and said to himself, "God, if I lose to Patrick, that's it. I'm jumping off the Sears Tower." Here's how failure motivated him. In 1979, he played mixed doubles at Wimbledon. He didn't play mixed doubles again for 20 years. Why? He and his partner lost in three straight sets. Plus, McEnroe lost his serve twice, while no one else lost theirs even once. That was the ultimate embarrassment. I said, "That's it. I'm never playing again. I can't handle this." In 1981, McEnroe bought a beautiful black Les Paul guitar. That week, he went to see Buddy Guy play at the Checkerboard Lounge in Chicago. Instead of feeling inspired to take lessons or practice, McEnroe went home and smashed his guitar to pieces. Here's how failure motivated Sergio Garcia, another golden boy with mindset issues. Garcia had taken the golf world by storm with his great shots and his charming boyish ways. He seemed like a younger Tiger. But when his performance took a dive, so did his charm. He fired caddy after caddy, blaming them for everything that went wrong. He once blamed his shoe when he slipped and missed a shot. To punish the shoe, he threw it and kicked it. Unfortunately, he almost hit an official. These are the ingenious remedies for failure in the fixed mindset. Taking charge of success. Finding number three. People with the growth mindset in sports, as in pre-med chemistry, took charge of the processes that bring success and that maintain it. How come Michael Jordan's skill didn't seem to decline with age? He did lose some stamina and agility with age, but to compensate, he worked even harder on conditioning and on his moves, like the turnaround jump shot and his celebrated fall-away jumper. He came into the league as a slam dunker, and he left as the most complete player ever to grace the game. Woods, too, takes charge of the process. Golf is like a wayward lover. When you think you've conquered her, she will certainly desert you. Butch Harmon, the renowned coach, says, "The golf swing is just about the farthest thing from a perfectible discipline in athletics. The most reliable swings are only relatively repeatable. They never stop being works in progress." That's why even the biggest golf star wins only a fraction of the time and may not win for long periods of time, which happened to Woods in the 2003 and 2004 seasons. And that's also why taking charge of the process is so crucial. With this in mind, Tiger's dad made sure to teach him how to manage his attention and his course strategy. Mr. Woods would make loud noises or throw things just as little Tiger was about to swing. This helped him become less distractible. Do we know someone else who could have profited from this training? When Tiger was 3 years old, his dad was already teaching him to think about course management. After Tiger drove the ball behind a big clump of trees, Mr. Woods asked the toddler what his plan was. Woods carries on what his dad started by taking control of all parts of his game. He experiments constantly with what works and what doesn't, but he also has a long-term plan that guides him. "I know my game. I know what I want to achieve. I know how to get there." Like Michael Jordan, Woods manages his motivation. He does this by making his practice into fun. "I love working on shots, carving them this way and that, and proving to myself that I can hit a certain shot on command." And he does it by thinking of a rival out there somewhere who will challenge him. "He's 12. I have to give myself a reason to work so hard. He's out there somewhere. He's 12. Mark O'Meara, Wood's golf partner and friend, had a choice. It's not easy to play beside someone as extraordinary as Woods. O'Meara's choice was this. He could feel jealous of and diminished by Wood's superior play, or he could learn from it. He chose the latter path. Omira was one of those talented players who never seemed to fulfill his potential. His choice to take charge of his game turned him around. At the age of 21, Woods had won the Masters tournament. That night, he slept with his arms around his prize, the famous green jacket. One year later, he put a green jacket on Mark O'Meara. From McEnroe, we hear little talk of taking control. When he was on top, we hear little mention of working on his game to stay on top. When he was doing poorly, we hear little self-reflection or analysis, except to pin the blame. For example, when he didn't do as well as expected for part of 82, we hear that little things happened that kept me off my game for weeks at a time and prevented me from dominating the tour. Always a victim of outside forces. Why didn't he take charge and learn how to perform well in spite of them? That's not the way of the fixed mindset. In fact, rather than combating those forces or fixing his problems, he tells us he wished he played a team sport so he could conceal his flaws. If you're not at your peak, you can hide it so much easier in a team sport. McEnroe also admits that his on-court temper tantrums were often a cover for choking and only made things worse. So what did he do? Nothing. He wished someone else would do it for him. When you can't control yourself, you want someone to do it for you. That's where I acutely missed being part of a team sport. People would have worked with me, coached me. Or, the system let me get away with more and more. I really liked it less and less. He got mad at the system. Hi there, John. This was your life. Ever think of taking responsibility? No, because in the fixed mindset, you don't take control of your abilities and your motivation. You look for your talent to carry you through, and when it doesn't, well then, what else could you have done? You are not a work in progress. You are a finished product, and finished products have to protect themselves, lament, and blame. Everything but take charge. What does it mean to be a star? Does a star have less responsibility to the team than other players? Is it just their role to be great and win games? Or does a star have more responsibility than others? What does Michael Jordan think? In our society, sometimes it's hard to come to grips with filling a role instead of trying to be a superstar, says Jordan. A superstar's talent can win games, but it's teamwork that wins championships. Coach John Wooden claims he was tactically and strategically average. So how did he win 10 national championships? One of the main reasons, he tells us, is because he was good at getting players to fill roles as part of a team. I believe, for example, I could have made Kareem Abdul-Jabbar the greatest scorer in college history. I could have done that by developing the team around that ability of his. Would we have won 3 national championships while he was at UCLA? Never. In the fixed mindset, athletes want to validate their talent. This means acting like a superstar, not just a team member. But as with Pedro Martinez, this mindset works against the important victories they want to achieve. A telling tale is the story of Patrick Ewing, who could have been a basketball champion. The year Ewing was a draft pick, by far the most exciting pick of the year, the Knicks won the lottery and to their joy got to select Ewing for their team. They now had twin towers, the 7-foot Ewing and the 7-foot Bill Cartwright, their high-scoring center. They had a chance to do it all. They just needed Ewing to be the power forward. He wasn't happy with that. Center is the star position. And maybe he wasn't sure he could hit the outside shots that a power forward has to hit. What if he had really given his all to learn that position? Alex Rodriguez, the best shortstop in baseball, agreed to play third base when he joined the Yankees. He had to retrain himself, and, for a while, he wasn't all he had been. Instead, Cartwright was sent to the Bulls, and Ewing's Knicks never won a championship. Then there is the tale of the football player Keyshawn Johnson, another immensely talented player who was devoted to validating his own greatness. When asked before a game how he compared to a star player on the opposing team, he replied, "You're trying to compare a flashlight to a star. Flashlights only last so long. A star is in the sky forever." Was he a team player? "I am a team player, but I'm an individual first. I have to be the number one guy with the football, not number 2 or number 3. If I'm not the number one guy, I'm no good to you. I can't really help you." What does that mean? For his definition of team player, Johnson was traded by the Jets, and after that, deactivated by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. I've noticed an interesting thing. When some star players are interviewed after a game, they say we. They are part of the team, and they think of themselves that way. When others are interviewed, they say I, and they refer to their teammates as something apart from themselves, as people who are privileged to participate in their greatness. Every sport is a team sport. You know, just about every sport is in some sense a team sport. No one does it alone. Even in individual sports like tennis or golf, great athletes have a team. Coaches, trainers, caddies, managers, mentors. This really hit me when I read about Diana Nyad, the woman who holds the world's record for open water swimming. What could be more of a lone sport than swimming? All right, maybe you need a little rowboat to follow you and make sure you're okay. When Nyad hatched her plan, the open water swimming record for both men and women was 60 miles. She wanted to swim 100. After months of arduous training, she was ready. But with her went a team of guides for measuring the winds and the current and watching for obstacles, divers looking for sharks, NASA experts for guidance on nutrition and endurance. She needed 1,100 calories per hour, and she lost 29 pounds on the trip. And trainers who talked her through uncontrollable shivers, nausea, hallucinations, and despair. Her new record, 102.5 miles, stands to this day. It is her name in the record books, but it took 51 other people to do it. Hearing the mindsets. You can already hear the mindsets in young athletes. Listen for them. It's 2004. Isis Tillis is a college basketball star, a 6'5" forward for the Duke University women's basketball team. She has a picture of her father, James Quick Tillis, taped to her locker as a motivator. But the picture is not a tribute, says sports writer Viv Bernstein. It is a reminder of all Tillis hopes she will never be. Quick Tillis was a contender in the 1980s. In 1981, he boxed for the world heavyweight title. In 1985, he was in the movie The Color Purple as a boxer. And in 1986, he was the first boxer to go the distance, 10 rounds, with Mike Tyson. But he never made it to the top. Isis Tillis, who is a senior, says, "This is the year to win a national championship. I just feel like I'd be such a failure. I'd feel like I'm regressing back and I'm going to end up like my dad, a nobody." Uh-oh. It's the somebody-nobody syndrome. If I win, I'll be somebody. If I lose, I'll be nobody. Tillis's anger at her father may be justified. He abandoned her as a child. But this thinking is getting in her way. Perhaps nobody else has that combination of size, skill, quickness, and vision in the women's college game, says Bernstein. Yet few would rate Tillis ahead of the top two players in the country, Connecticut's Diana Taurasi and Duke's Alana Beard. Tillis's performance often fails to match her ability. She's frustrated that people have high expectations for her and want her to play better. I feel like I have to come out and have a triple-double, double digits in points scored, rebounds, and assists. Dunk the ball over the head 360, leave your feet, turn completely around in the air, and slam the ball into the basket. And maybe people will be like, "Oh, she's not that bad." I don't think people want the impossible. I think they just want to see her use her wonderful talent to the utmost. I think they want her to develop the skills she needs to reach her goals. Worrying about being a nobody is not the mindset that motivates and sustains champions. Hard as it is, perhaps Tillis should admire the fact that her father went for it, instead of being contemptuous that he didn't quite make it. Somebodies are not determined by whether they won or lost. Somebodies are people who go for it with all they have. If you go for it with all you have, Isis Tillis, not just in the games, but in practice too, you will already be somebody. Here's another mindset. It's 6'3" Candace Parker, then a 17-year-old senior at Naperville Central High near Chicago, who is going to Tennessee to play for the Lady Vols and their great coach, Pat Summitt. Candace has a very different father from Isis, a dad who is teaching her a different lesson. If you work hard at something, you get out what you put in. Several years before, when he was coach of her team, her dad lost his cool with her during a tournament game. She was not going for the rebounds. She was shooting lazy shots from the outside instead of using her height near the basket, and she was not exerting herself on defense. Now let's go out and try harder. So what happened? She went out and scored 20 points in the second half and had 10 rebounds. They blew the other team away. He lit a fire under me, and I knew he was right. Candace lights the same fire under herself now. Rather than being content to be a star, she looks to improve all the time. When she returned from knee surgery, she knew what she needed to work on: her timing, nerves, and wind. When her three-point shot went bad, she asked her father to come to the gym to work on it with her. Whether it be in basketball or everyday life, she says, nothing is promised. Only weeks later, the mindset prophecies were already coming true. Two things happened. One, sadly, is that Telus's team was knocked out of the championship. The other was that Candace Parker became the first woman ever to win the basketball dunking championship against five men. Character, heart, the mind of a champion. It's what makes great athletes, and it's what comes from the growth mindset with its focus on self-development, self-motivation, and responsibility. Even though the finest athletes are wildly competitive and want to be the best, greatness does not come from the ego of the fixed mindset with its somebody-nobody syndrome. Many athletes with the fixed mindset may have been naturals, but you know what? As John Wooden says, we can't remember most of them. Grow your mindset. Are there sports you always assumed you're bad at? Well, maybe you are, but then maybe you aren't. It's not something you can know until you've put in a lot of effort. Some of the world's best athletes didn't start out being that hot. If you have a passion for a sport, put in the effort and see. Sometimes being exceptionally endowed is a curse. These athletes may stay in a fixed mindset and not cope well with adversity. Is there a sport that came easily to you until you hit a wall? Try on the growth mindset and go for it again. Character is an important concept in the sports world, and it comes out of a growth mindset. Think about times you've needed to reach deep down inside in difficult sports matches. Think about the growth mindset champions from this chapter and how they do it. What could you do next time to make sure you're in a growth mindset in the pinch? Athletes with a growth mindset find success in learning and improving, not just winning. The more you can do this, the more rewarding sports will be for you and for those who play them with you. Chapter 5. Business, Mindset, and Leadership. Enron and the Talent Mindset. In 2001 came the announcement that shocked the corporate world. Enron, the corporate poster child at the company of the future, had gone belly up. What happened? How did such spectacular promise turn into such a spectacular disaster? Was it incompetence? Was it corruption? It was mindset. According to Malcolm Gladwell, writing in The New Yorker, American corporations had become obsessed with talent. Indeed, the gurus at McKinsey & Company, the premier management consulting firm in the country, were insisting that corporate success today requires the talent mindset. Just as there are naturals in sport, they maintained there are naturals in business. Just as sports teams write huge checks to sign outsized talent, so too should corporations spare no expense in recruiting talent, for this is the secret weapon, the key to beating the competition. As Gladwell writes, this talent mindset is the new orthodoxy of American management. It created the blueprint for the Enron culture and sowed the seeds of its demise. Enron recruited big talent, mostly people with fancy degrees, which is not in itself so bad. It paid them big money, which is not that terrible. But by putting complete faith in talent, Enron did a fatal thing. It created a culture that worshipped talent, thereby forcing its employees to look and act extraordinarily talented. Basically, it forced them into the fixed mindset, and we know a lot about that. We know from our studies that people with the fixed mindset do not admit and correct their deficiencies. Remember the study where we interviewed students from the University of Hong Kong, where everything is in English? Students with the fixed mindset were so worried about appearing deficient that they refused to take a course that would improve their English. They did not live in a psychological world where they could take this risk. And remember how we put students into a fixed mindset by praising their intelligence, much as Enron had done with its star employees. Later, after some hard problems, we asked the students to write a letter to someone in another school describing their experience in our study. When we read their letters, we were shocked. Almost 40% of them had lied about their scores, always in the upward direction. The fixed mindset had made a flaw intolerable. Gladwell concludes that when people live in an environment that esteems them for their innate talent, they have great difficulty when their image is threatened. They will not take the remedial course. They will not stand up to investors and the public and admit that they were wrong. They'd sooner lie. Obviously, a company that cannot self-correct cannot thrive. If Enron was done in by its fixed mindset, does it follow that companies that thrive have a growth mindset? Let's see. Organizations that grow. Jim Collins set out to discover what made some companies move from being good to being great. What was it that allowed them to make the leap to greatness and stay there, while other comparable companies just held steady at good? To answer this question, he and his research team embarked on a 5-year study. They selected 11 companies whose stock returns had skyrocketed relative to other companies in their industry and maintained this edge for at least 15 years. They matched each company to another one in the same industry that had similar resources, but did not make the leap. He also studied a third group of companies, ones that had made a leap from good to great, but did not sustain it. What distinguished the thriving companies from the others? There were several important factors, as Collins reports in his book, Good to Great, but one that was absolutely key was the type of leader who, in every case, led the company into greatness. These were not the larger-than-life, charismatic types who oozed ego and self-proclaimed talent. They were self-effacing people who constantly asked questions and had the ability to confront the most brutal answers, that is, to look failures in the face, even their own, while maintaining faith that they would succeed in the end. Does this sound familiar? Collins wonders why his effective leaders have these particular qualities and why these qualities go together the way they do, and how these leaders came to acquire them. But we know they have the growth mindset. They believe in human development. And these are the hallmarks. They're not constantly trying to prove they're better than others. For example, they don't highlight the pecking order with themselves at the top. They don't claim credit for other people's contributions, and they don't undermine others to feel powerful. Instead, they are constantly trying to improve. They surround themselves with the most able people they can find. They look squarely at their own mistakes and deficiencies, and they ask frankly what skills they and the company will need in the future. And because of this, they can move forward with confidence that's grounded in the facts, not built on fantasies about their talent. Collins reports that Alan Wurtzel, the CEO of the giant electronics chain Circuit City, held debates in his boardroom. Rather than simply trying to impress his board of directors, he used them to learn. With his executive team as well, he questioned, debated, prodded, until he slowly gained a clearer picture of where the company was and where it needed to go. "They used to call me the prosecutor because I would hone in on a question," Wurtzel told Collins. "You know, like a bulldog. I wouldn't let go until I understood. Why? Why? Why?" Wurtzel considered himself a plow horse, a hard-working, no-nonsense, normal kind of guy. But he took a company that was close to bankruptcy and over the next 15 years turned it into one that delivered the highest total return to its stockholders of any firm on the New York Stock Exchange. A study of mindset and management decisions. Robert Wood and Albert Bandura did a fascinating study with graduate students in business, many of whom had management experience. In their study, they created Enron-type managers and Wurtzel-type managers by putting people into different mindsets. Wood and Bandura gave these budding business leaders a complex management task in which they had to run a simulated organization, a furniture company. In this computerized task, they had to place employees in the right jobs and decide how best to guide and motivate these workers. To discover the best ways, they had to keep revising their decisions based on the feedback they got about employee productivity. The researchers divided the business students into two groups. One group was given a fixed mindset. They were told that the task measured their basic underlying capabilities. The higher their capacity, the better their performance. The other group was given a growth mindset. They were told that management skills were developed through practice, and that the task would give them an opportunity to cultivate these skills. The task was hard because students were given high production standards to meet, and especially in their early attempts, they fell short. As at Enron, those with the fixed mindset did not profit from their mistakes. But those with the growth mindset kept on learning. Not worried about measuring or protecting their fixed abilities, they looked directly at their mistakes, used the feedback, and altered their strategies accordingly. They became better and better at understanding how to deploy and motivate their workers, and their productivity kept pace. In fact, they ended up way more productive than those with the fixed mindset. What's more, through this rather grueling task, they maintained a healthy sense of confidence. They operated like Alan Wurtzel. Leadership and the fixed mindset. In contrast to Alan Wurtzel, the leaders of Collins's comparison companies had every symptom of the fixed mindset writ large. Fixed mindset leaders, like fixed mindset people in general, live in a world where some people are superior and some are inferior. They must repeatedly affirm that they are superior, and the company is simply a platform for this. Collins's comparison leaders were typically concerned with their reputation for personal greatness, so much so that they often set the company up to fail when their regime ended. As Collins puts it, after all, what better testament to your own personal greatness than that the place falls apart after you leave? In more than two-thirds of these leaders, the researchers saw a gargantuan personal ego that either hastened the demise of the company or kept it second rate. One such leader was Lee Iacocca, head of Chrysler, who achieved a miraculous turnaround for his company, then spent so much time grooming his fame that in the second half of his tenure, the company plunged back into mediocrity. Many of these comparison companies operated on what Collins calls a genius with a thousand helpers model. Instead of building an extraordinary management team like the good to great companies, they operated on the fixed mindset premise that great geniuses do not need great teams. They just need little helpers to carry out their brilliant ideas. Don't forget that these great geniuses don't want great teams either. Fixed mindset people want to be the only big fish so that when they compare themselves to those around them, they can feel a cut above the rest. In not one autobiography of a fixed mindset CEO did I read much about mentoring or employee development programs. In every growth mindset autobiography, there was deep concern with personal development and extensive discussion of it. Finally, as with Enron, the geniuses refused to look at their deficiencies. Says Collins, the good-to-great Kroger grocery chain looked bravely at the danger signs in the 1970s, signs that the old-fashioned grocery store was becoming extinct. Meanwhile, its counterpart, A&P, once the largest retailing organization in the world, shut its eyes. For example, when A&P opened a new kind of store, a superstore, and it seemed to be more successful than the old kind, they closed it down. It was not what they wanted to hear. In contrast, Kroger eliminated or changed every single store that did not fit the new superstore model, and by the end of the 1990s, it had become the number one grocery chain in the country. CEOs and the Big Ego. How did CEO and gargantuan ego become synonymous? If it's the more self-effacing, growth-minded people who are the true shepherds of industry, why are so many companies out looking for larger-than-life leaders, even when these leaders may in the end be more committed to themselves than to the company? Blame Iacocca. According to James Surowiecki, writing in Slate, Iacocca's rise to prominence was a turning point for American business. Before him, the days of tycoons and moguls seemed long past. In the public's mind, CEO meant a button-down organization man, well-treated and well-paid, but essentially bland and characterless. With Iacocca, all of that changed. Business journalists began dubbing executives the next J.P. Morgan or the next Henry Ford, and fixed-mindset executives started vying for those labels. Surowiecki even traces the recent corporate scandals to this change, for as the trend continued, CEOs became superheroes, but the people who preen their egos and look for the next self-image boost are not the same people who foster long-term corporate health. Maybe Iacocca is just a charismatic guy who, like rock and roll, is being blamed for the demise of civilization. Is that fair? Let's look at him more closely. And let's look at some other fixed-mindset CEOs. Albert Dunlap of Scott Paper and Sunbeam, Jerry Levin and Steve Case of AOL Time Warner, and Kenneth Lay and Jeffrey Skilling of Enron. You'll see they all start with the belief that some people are superior. They all have the need to prove and display their superiority. They all use their subordinates to feed this need rather than fostering the development of their workers. And they all end by sacrificing their companies to this need. The fixed mindset helps us understand where gargantuan egos come from, how they operate, and why they become self-defeating. Fixed Mindset Leaders in Action. Iacocca, I'm a Hero. Warren Bennis, the leadership guru, studied the world's greatest corporate leaders. These great leaders said they didn't set out to be leaders. They'd had no interest in proving themselves. They just did what they loved, with tremendous drive and enthusiasm, and it led where it led. Iacocca wasn't like that. Yes, he loved the car business, but more than anything, he yearned to be a muckamuck at Ford. He craved the approval of Henry Ford II and the royal trappings of office. These were the things he could measure himself by, the things that would prove he was somebody. I use the term royal with good reason. Iacocca tells us the glass house, Ford corporate headquarters, was a palace, and Henry Ford was the king. What's more, if Henry was the king, I was the crown prince. I was His Majesty's special protege. All of us lived the good life in the royal court. We were part of something beyond first class, royal class. White-coated waiters were on call throughout the day, and we all ate lunch together in the executive dining room. Dover sole was flown over from England on a daily basis. Iacocca achieved great things at Ford, like nurturing and promoting the Ford Mustang, and he dreamed of succeeding Henry Ford as the CEO of the company. But Henry Ford had other ideas, and much to Iacocca's shock and rage, he eventually forced Iacocca out. It's interesting that Iacocca was shocked and that he harbored an enduring rage against Henry Ford. After all, he had seen Henry Ford fire top people, and he, Iacocca, had used the axe quite liberally on others. He knew the corporate game. Yet his fixed mindset clouded his vision. I had always clung to the idea that I was different, that somehow I was smarter or luckier than the rest. I didn't think it would ever happen to me. His belief in his inherent superiority had blinded him. Now the other side of the fixed mindset kicked in. He wondered whether Henry Ford had detected a flaw in him. Maybe he wasn't superior after all. And that's why he couldn't let go. Years later, his second wife told him to get over it. You don't realize what a favor Henry Ford did for you. Getting fired from Ford brought you to greatness. You're richer, more famous, and more influential because of Henry Ford. Thank him. Shortly thereafter, he divorced her. So the king, who had defined him as competent and worthy, now rejected him as flawed. With ferocious energy, Iacocca applied himself to the monumental task of saving face and, in the process, Chrysler Motors. Chrysler, the once thriving Ford rival, was on the brink of death. But Iacocca, as its new CEO, acted quickly to hire the right people, bring out new models, and lobby the government for bailout loans. Just a few years after his humiliating exit from Ford, he was able to write a triumphant autobiography and in it declare, "Today, I'm a hero." Within a short time, however, Chrysler was in trouble again. Iacocca's fixed mindset would not stay put. He needed to prove his greatness, to himself, to Henry Ford, to the world, on a larger and larger scale. He spent his company time on things that would enhance his public image, and he spent the company's money on things that would impress Wall Street and hike up Chrysler's stock prices. But he did this instead of investing in new car designs or manufacturing improvements that would keep the company profitable in the long run. He also looked to history, to how he would be judged and remembered. But he did not address this concern by building the company. Quite the contrary. According to one of his biographers, he worried that his underlings might get credit for successful new designs, so he balked at approving them. He worried, as Chrysler faltered, that his underlings might be seen as the new saviors, so he tried to get rid of them. He worried that he would be written out of Chrysler history, so he desperately hung on as CEO long after he had lost his effectiveness. Iacocca had a golden opportunity to make a difference, to leave a great legacy. The American auto industry was facing its biggest challenge ever. Japanese imports were taking over the American market. It was simple. They looked better and they ran better. Iacocca's own people had done a detailed study of Honda and made excellent suggestions to him. But rather than take up the challenge and delivering better cars, Iacocca, mired in his fixed mindset, delivered blame and excuses. He went on the rampage, spewing angry diatribes against the Japanese and demanding that the American government impose tariffs and quotas that would stop them. In an editorial against Iacocca, the New York Times scolded, "The solution lies in making better cars in this country, not in angrier excuses."